It's Ideasphere, a platform for today's voices with David Rose, Enchanted Objects.
What we're talking about when you talk about Internet of Things usually doesn't involve a screen and a keyboard and a cellular connection. Usually it's a Bluetooth connection or a Wi-Fi connection or some lower cost wireless chipset. And so I think we'll be able to embed internet connection in even things that you perceive as disposable today, like medication packaging or cosmetics packaging or pens and pencils.
No one truly knows what the future will look like, but there are a few who have insight, just as David Rose. He's an award-winning entrepreneur and MIT lab scientist. His vision is that our smartphones and tablets will soon be replaced by what he calls enchanted objects. Take an everyday object such as a teacup. It knows what you're drinking, or an umbrella that knows when it's going to rain. How about a pen that records sounds and gestures, or a programmable Legos? Pill bottles that tweet. They have extraordinary powers. You get the idea. Hello, I'm Guy Rothbun. Welcome to Ideasphere, a platform for today's voices. Rose feels that these objects will make our homes, workplaces, and cities more efficient, more connected, and, more importantly, more humane. In his book, Enchanted Objects, Rose shows how this seemingly fantastic vision for the Internet of Everything is already becoming reality in labs at MIT and elsewhere. Mr. Rose, thanks so much for joining me for this program.
Hey, it's great to be here. I'm excited to talk about the emerging world of connected things.
I was a little taken aback, but not completely, when I ran across the beginning of your book, which says we are essentially, because of the industry, the way it's built, stuck with these flat screens. I'm staring at one right now, and we don't really need that.
Yeah, I think most people assume that the future will look like more of the same in terms of how our attention is being completely monopolized by these black glass slabs that we all seem to carry around all day and stare at. And I'm hoping for a very different future. And I think it's inevitable that we will have more options in terms of how we consume information. And I think it will really change completely our relationship to technology and how we think about technology.
One of those is the crystal ball. I'll call it that. We see that whenever we look at a fortune teller in a cartoon or at a carnival. But you think that has legitimate calling in our future?
Well, I think the means are now available to connect almost everything. And one of the products that I developed in my last company called Ambient Devices, which it was a glowing glass orb. And the orb would tell you almost any information that was online, sort of how stocks are performing, either more up and the orb sort of shifts to green, or more down and the orb shifts to red. And that ability to signal any sort of constantly changing information, whether it's stocks or weather or traffic information or the pollen count if you suffer from asthma, or even your own blood sugar levels if you're diabetic, give people a sense of glanceability of information which you don't have with apps. And that's one of the features that I think is really differentiates connected objects, is that they can be calmly showing you information in your periphery so that you can respond when you want to. I think the Apple Watch actually is paying attention to this. And you know, you can think of the watch is essentially means that all of the things that used to be on our phone can now, some of them, if appropriate, can be embedded into a device that we wear.
I couldn't help but feel like I was embedded in the world of Harry Potter when I was looking through your book.
Right. Well, there's so many objects from fiction, either from spy culture or from myths like the myth of Icarus, or from fairy tales like Hans Christian Andersen, or the Grimm fairy tales like Snow White, where you have information embedded in mirrors and embedded in boots and tables and all these other story patterns that I think are really inspiring for the world of today's enchanters, the people that are making internet-connected things. So in the book, I go back and forth between these fictional examples and these real examples of things that we're creating today, like internet-connected jewelry or surfaces like mirrors, or even tables. I have a table in my living room that embeds Google Earth. So you can just sit there in the living room and have a conversation about the world and then easily look things up and see what the weather is and where the earthquakes are happening and where the news is breaking because you're sitting in around a big zoomable map. Mm-hmm.
You break apart everything in your book in four sections: terminal world, prosthetics, animism, and enchanted objects. The terminal world, terminal meaning we're plugged in, essentially, and that is the work you just described about the glass slab in front of us or on the iPad.
Right. In the book, I talk about four very different futures that locate technology in different places relative to us. And the first future is the future of glass slabs, which demand our attention and interrupt us and are, you know, ultimately like pretty obnoxious in terms of how we interact with them.
Yes.
The second future is when we locate technology in and on ourselves. So this is the Google Glass future where we're wearing the tech. And I think it's problematic because I think we'll be looking at a different version of our world. We'll each be looking at a different version of our world based, you know, our own privatized view. And so it will really hurt human interaction because we won't share the same view of what we're all seeing, because some of us will have different augmentations and some of us will choose not to see certain things. I don't want to live in a future like that. The third future is one where we outsource our technology to robots. This is the robotics community has always wanted us to have things like R2-D2 or from Metropolis, but we've also seen from fiction that sort of catastrophic results of that in terms of Frankenstein or zombies. And I think what's problematic about the robotic fantasy is that the closer these things become to look human-like, the more they threaten our own humanity, and we really won't want to have them around us. So I think the most desirable future is one that is the fourth future, is the future of enchanted objects, where we have all the things that are around us today become a little bit smarter and a little bit more connected. So umbrellas show us if it's going to rain, and our coffee tables become embedded with maps or photographs, where our cabinetry, we can open it and see loved ones that are in remote locations. But all of these ordinary things and ordinary gestures become places where the technology can help.
One of the problems that sociologists and others have discovered is that how we relate to the objects really depend on how human-like they are. And yet, if they're too human, then we are repelled.
Right. Well, and ultimately, if it's too humanoid, we have very high expectations, and those expectations are often dashed. I mean, think about your relationship with Siri. I don't know if you've been using Siri, but Siri aims to be omniscient person in our life who we can ask any question to. And I think most of us have failed relationships with Siri because she doesn't identify her own boundaries with the types of questions she's able to ask. I feel like a better relationship to technology is one not where you have a big artificial intelligence or a big AI, like that's sort of what HAL was on 2001, A Space Odyssey. But I think a better way forward is to have little AIs, sort of little pieces of functionality that are all relatively dumb, but they serve us in very clear and understandable and tangible ways. I mean, think about a lot of the features that have gone into automobiles over the last 10 years are little AIs, like anti-lock brakes, where if you're in a situation and you lose traction, it will pump the brakes 1,000 times a second, and so you don't skid. But it's not trying to have a relationship with you, and it's not trying to, you know, take over your life and do too much. It's just trying to get the car to stop faster. Or systems that turn the radio down if a call comes in, or systems that turn on your windshield wipers at the right rate when it's raining. Like all of those are like little AIs that are very convenient and that sort of take away the mundane and the drudgery of certain tasks, but aren't trying to replace the loved ones in our lives.
Well, this is interesting you bring this up because the sociologists, many of them right now, and I'll be quoting one as we gather more information here in the interview, but their concern is that in our effort to automate everything, we're losing the human touch. And on top of that, humans are becoming less and less critical.
I think there are certain jobs, and a lot of economists are writing about this, that are rote and that robots should take over. I think actually a lot of automation is helping humans understand what are those things that we do uniquely. And those are things around creativity and innovation and really the ways that we'd want to spend our time. I look at enchanted objects and I think they'll affect societal issues like health and transportation and housing. I'm working on a project right now at MIT that tries to create a transformer home where all of the space-hogging furniture like beds and desks and tables can all compact and nest into the floor and into ceilings so that a young professional living in a city can live in a 300-square-foot apartment or a 400-square-foot apartment rather than a 1,000 or 1,500-square-foot apartment. And so I think the effect of internet-connected things will be great, and it will be on energy and resource consumption, helping us understand how much electricity we're using, how much water we're using, and even things like creativity and expression will be impacted. I was one of the team on a product called Guitar Hero, which was a tool that gave many people a feeling that they could learn an instrument. So rather than being frustrated for an entire year when you're learning an instrument, like my daughter is learning cello right now, it was a tool that provided a game and a real tangible guitar that you could hold in your hand, and it allowed you to immediately feel more in control, more performative, and really gave you a sense of success. And a lot of people don't feel that when they're playing an instrument. Mm-hmm. And so you very quickly learn a little bit about the instrument, and then you could work your way into mastery. One of the most attractive categories of enchanted objects are those tools that help us become more creative or more expressive. I would love for everybody to enjoy the pleasures of generating music or playing an instrument with other people. And for many people, that's sort of, they don't feel, that feel like that's out of reach. And when we developed the Guitar Hero product, that was designed to help almost anybody feel mastery and feel that thrill, the rush of the crowd, of being in front of a group of people and playing and improvising and making music with a set of other people. And we could do that because we had the technology of this guitar that looks like you wear an ordinary guitar. But because it's a game and because you're given a set of tasks that are not as complicated as forming chords, people feel some sense of mastery within 20 or 30 minutes, and then they can begin to learn more complex things about the guitar. But I think enchanted objects have the ability to really change people's feeling about being able to draw or being able to invent or being able to make music. So I'm most hopeful about that category.
You didn't like Google Glass so much. This is surprising, but part of it is because we're just creating that terminal station only closer to our faces.
Yeah, I got a chance to go out to Google and try Google Glass, and I guess I was disappointed for a couple of reasons. I think first, by choosing to wear a screen on your face, it's almost necessarily socially isolating. And so I think it's going to be a long time before most of us feel comfortable with making that choice about how apparent to wear a technology. Because as soon as you put things over the eyes, it really challenges our ability to interact with each other. I think also the cues about do you know if the glass is recording or not can be suppressed, and so you don't really understand whether someone's filming or not filming, and I think that's problematic. And also I think there's really a missed opportunity in terms of the floating screen. The Google Glass presents this screen which appears to be about 2 feet by 3 feet and hanging out about 6 feet in front of your face. What it doesn't do, which it should, is to look at the space that you're looking at and project information that's relevant in the space that you're looking at. So if there's a wall that you're sitting across from, the information should be cast onto the wall. Or if you're driving, it should be cast onto the road in front of you. So it should have some sense of what you're seeing and embed information in that way. So there's a lot of work to be done.
In case you're just tuning in, talking with David Rose, author of the book Enchanted Objects. It's now available from Scribner Press. You have a website, blog, or anything else you'd like to introduce folks to?
I do have a blog at enchantedobjects.com, where I'm writing about new things and my ambivalence about drones and other topics. Yeah. What should happen with the data that all of these objects cast off, or what new business models are created by always having a tether to the cloud?
There are some worrisome issues about the new technology, but one of them is moving into the narrative chip, as you call it. This is just a step beyond Google in the respect that you don't have the terminal feeling.
Right. So this is a button or a little clip that is a camera that takes a photograph every 30 seconds and stores where you were when the photograph was taken. And the goal of the narrative clip is to create a little flipbook of your day that helps you remember the high points of your day. And it really reveals a lot about how you spend your time. I mean, I've been wearing the thing for about a month now. You really notice, if you look through this flipbook, it creates this digital portrait of how often was I outside or inside or interacting with people versus interacting with my screens. And it really requires that you have, I think, a computer vision system to analyze all these photos, because it's just this cacophonous amount of photos. And actually, the company that I founded and now CEO of is called Ditto Labs. We're trying to build the computer vision system that would look at all these photos and find meaning in all of the photos. So if you put the photos through this system, you can get a demo at streamditto.com. You can start to see faces that are in the photos, expressions on the face, brands or products that are in the photos. It really offers a way to start to understand this huge torrent of photos that we're all either taking and sharing on social media or that are being taken with little wearable cameras.
Now, how much time are we going to have to be able to relive our day if we're doing every 30 seconds? Would this be something you're thinking we would do in the evening every day to rehash what we've done?
Well, I think it's a good question about how, if everything is captured, how should it be summarized? I think there's this notion of metadata, which is sort of the data about the data, where I don't think we want to look at all these photos, but if a machine can look at all these photos, it can start to see how often are you meeting with groups of people, how much sunlight are you getting. Of the people that you're interacting with, do they seem to be depressed or do they seem to be happier, which is sort of a signal of your own depression because we all mirror each other. And so I think there's a lot to be learned by having sensors that capture everyday activities, whether it's how many steps you walk or how often you snack or who you interact with. And these new digital portraits of ourselves will help us, you know, really understand more about the choices that we're making.
One of the things that you have discovered in your work extensively is the cost, which is coming down. But what I was thinking about as I was seeing all these things was how much of our population, specifically America, can afford these gadgets, because there's such an inequity of income. The divide is so great today, and it projects into the future to get even worse. Will these products be available to the vast majority of Americans?
I think we will be impressed with how cheap this technology becomes very, very quickly. I just saw a presentation this week of a cell phone with all of the componentry of the cell phone for $9, for a $9 cost of goods. And what we're talking about when you talk about Internet of Things usually doesn't involve a screen and a keyboard and a cellular connection. Usually it's a Bluetooth connection or a Wi-Fi connection or some lower cost wireless chipset. And so I think we'll be able to embed internet connection in even things that you perceive as disposable today, like medication packaging or cosmetics packaging or pens and pencils. Really, the cost will not be an issue. I think there will be many companies that do differentiate themselves through fashion and through luxury that will adopt internet connection. So I think you'll see very high-priced things like earrings and brooches and shoes and women's purses and other things that have sensors and are able to display information. And those will be still in the crazy high price points of tens and hundreds and thousands of dollars. But again, those will be differentiated by fashion, not by technology.
Enchanted Objects, Design, Human Desire, and the Internet of Things. David Rose, MIT scientist and entrepreneur. Check out his blog at enchantedobjects.com. If you'd like to hear this program in its entirety, you can do so by going to Public Radio Exchange, prx.org, or National Public Radio's podcasts at npr.org. This is Ideasphere. We'll be right back. You're back with Ideasphere, a platform for today's voices. David Rose, author of the book Enchanted Objects, award-winning entrepreneur and instructor at MIT Media Lab. I want to return to objectivity that you refer to as ubiquitous in the five steps of the Enchanted Objects. If we can, very quickly go through those five steps, because you move from connection to personalization and then socialization, which is very critical.
Sure. Well, I describe in the book a framework for thinking about if you have an ordinary object, what are the stepwise ways you may want to add enchantment to that object. So I take the case of a trash can and say, how would you make a trash can, like the most ordinary, ubiquitous object around, how would you make that enchanted? So the first step is to make it connected so it can talk to the cloud. In the case of our trash can, we added a camera sensor and a barcode sensor to the inside lid of the trash can and connected it to a network so it would know what's thrown away. And the next step was personalization. So we wanted to know, what are the items that you order regularly from Amazon? And maybe these things could be added to your wish list. So it would know something about what's being thrown away in the house. And the account associated with that could be an Amazon account, for example. The next step is socialization, which is, how does the device or service engage your social network? And one of the ways that that happens is through Facebook or through Twitter. So our trash can could tweet. It could tweet when you're eating food like vegetables and fruits, and it could also tell on you if you were eating things that were against your goal. just to be provocative. And then the next step is gamification. So this is using some of the same mechanisms that we use today in video games, mechanisms like points and badges and streaks. So if you do certain things every day in a row, you get more accolades or more points for doing those things. And the last step of the ladder of enchantment is storyification, which is, how does a story get embedded in the object that you relate to? In the case of our trash can, we decided that there would be somebody who lives in the trash can, like Oscar the Grouch from Sesame Street. And Oscar gives you a hard time about those things that you throw out that are not in your interest, like, third box of cookies this week, are you sure? Or coconut water all the way from Asia, like, are you sure you want me to order more things all the way from Asia? Or something that's extraordinarily expensive, like if you throw out strawberries and they're out of season, it might say, are you sure you want out of season expensive strawberries? Why not blueberries? So by living in the trash can, Oscar can give you feedback on what you're reordering and help you make better choices. And if you don't like what he's saying, you just kick the can and tell him to shut up.
Let's go back to that third step in the socialization. And September issue of Scientific America, Shirley Turkle, who is a sociologist with MIT, is interviewed, and she's greatly concerned about the lack of socialization that's happening among especially the millennials and earlier now, from the point of 2 years old, there's no identity with other human beings.
Well, this is the problem with the future of glass slabs, is that they really monopolize our attention, and we tend to prioritize these virtual interactions over personal face-to-face interactions. I totally agree with Sherry on this, and I think the way out of this is through enchanted objects. I mean, the Internet of Things will allow us to take the apps that are so capturing our attention today and distribute them into clothing, into furniture, into surfaces, so that we can get back to interacting with the people that we care about most in the real world, rather than interacting with those people through apps.
And I can wear this special jacket or sweater when I'm on Facebook, and when I get a like, it'll hug me.
Yeah, one of my students did a project that was called a Like a Hug Jacket. This is the idea that you could embed feedback from a social network into your clothing. So you wouldn't have to go back to the social network in order to understand if someone's liking something. You could just feel it because the jacket just puffs up a little bit and gives you a little bit of a hug.
What about dumbing down? The last thought I want here, perhaps, is Nicholas Carr, who has written extensively about future and technology, and he has a new book out now. His reference is that we're dumbing down, that we're not learning anymore. The computers are learning for us. It's maintaining our memory. And professionals like doctors and pilots don't have to know as much. And actually, pilots aren't flying the plane. They're only actually in control maybe 2 or 3 minutes during a flight.
Well, maybe pilots don't need to be flying the planes if we can have algorithms fly the planes. I think that humans should focus on those things that humans can do uniquely, which is creativity and being generative and innovating. I'm not worried if a job that could be made into an algorithm is made into an algorithm. I think that frees us up to not spend all our time doing things that we wouldn't really want to do anyway.
Is there anything we have overlooked you think is really important to this discussion that I don't want to pass up on?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest impacts that the Internet of Things will have is to change businesses. You know, if you think about any tangible product, take a piece of luggage. Samsonite is trying to figure out how to differentiate their luggage from Tumi or some other luggage company. And they've done that through material and wheels and colors. But now, if they can embed like a chipset for less than $5 into a piece of luggage that helps you understand where is your luggage, or that your luggage is coming up on the carousel, or that you're not walking out of the airport with your bag, it's somebody else's bag, just think about what that will do to a luggage company. They really have to respond, and it's a huge opportunity for them to think about what sort of services that they can create in addition to the hardware that they already sell. And so I'm really excited about what this means to almost any hardware company, whether it's a shoe company or a chair company or a luggage company or a pick any hardware example. Those products will become things that can be imbued with services and that can have a tether to the customer, can really change the potential for how those things are priced and what the relationship looks like between the brand and the customer.
Well, David Rose, it's been a pleasure reading your book and finding out what our future might be and discussing it with you now.
I've really enjoyed the conversation. Thanks for your interest in enchanted objects.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
See you later.
Take care. Enchanted Objects, Design, Human Desire, and the Internet of Things. David Rose. Check out his blog at enchantedobjects.com. If you have any comments about this broadcast, write to me at rathbunproductions@gmail.com. This program is a distribution of Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org. For Ideasphere, I'm Guy Rathbun.